environmental justice, and it is defined in statute as the fair treatment of all races, cultures, and incomes with respect to the development, adoption, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. Mr. Curtis, would you like to introduce this office?
Thank you, Dr. Horn, members of the board. My name is Chuck Curtis. I'm a supervising engineer in the Lake Tahoe office. This evening's item is to give the board, staff, and the public, the partner organizations, an overview of environmental justice and how it intersects with our work. First, we'll hear from Anita Kapani from the Office of Public Participation of the State Water Resources Control Board. I'll give a brief presentation on the Oaxaca region-specific environmental justice. And then we will follow with Mark Drew and Holly Walker from the Indian Memorial Integrated Regional Water Management Group, and then Kirby Brill from the Mojave Berwyn Group will also give the presentation on that. So, thank you. Welcome,
Anita. Thank you, Chuck. Got to pull this up. I'm short, so I'm not going to be able to see all
of you. Oh, it's so far away.
I know. Don't get up closer.
Yeah.
Okay. This is really, it can, but it's making the supports on the side.
She has her laptop, so maybe she might need this bit of counseling.
All right, here. Okay. I'll do it like this. And then just to be all advanced on the website. So, thank you very much for having me tonight. Dr. Warren, members of the board, and staff, I just wanted to let you know a little bit about what the Office of Public Participation does in terms of environmental justice work. Some folks may not know that the water boards have an environmental justice program, an Office of Public Participation. I'm the director of that office. It was created about 8 years ago. Before that, we really didn't do a lot. We did things regarding public participation, but we didn't really have an office that coordinated those efforts. Since then, we've made a lot of headway. My job includes being the ombudsman, environmental justice coordinator, tribal liaison, education outreach, and et cetera, et cetera. There are many hats that I wear, and it's all linked. And my 25 years with the Water Board has helped me do what I do today, so I'm happy to do that. I do serve all the state and regional boards, and so Oaxaca is one of my favorites. So work closely with staff and exec in your region, and especially with some of the issues in Hinckley and other areas. So with that, environmental justice. This presentation I gave at the WPCC last October. Some of the board members were there. WPCC is a water quality coordinating committee. Can everyone hear me? So WPCC is meeting an annual meeting of all the water board members statewide that get together once a year. Last year, the two topics of interest to the board members, which they vote on, number one was climate change, number two was dismantling communities and environmental justice. So we gave presentations, we had panel members. Some of what I'm going to present today is a repeat of that, but I'll also show you what we're doing since that meeting. Next slide, please. So there are state and federal definitions. There's federal guidance and state guidance. I'm going to talk a little bit about the water board's progress, some of the issues and challenges, and how we are moving forward. So this, next slide, please. So this definition has been in statute for almost 15 years, and it's important to note that EJ, environmental justice, can mean different things to different people. And oftentimes, definitions can be limiting and maybe offensive to some. So it's something we need to be cognizant of. The state guidance, there is a Cal EPA, California Environmental Protection Agency, intra-agency EJ strategy, and it was done in the mid-2005.
there has been no formal policy, and it is something that we as an agency may consider doing in the future. We also have a CALIPA policy for working with California Indian tribes that was written in 2009. It is in the process of being updated. The governor signed an executive order in 2011 that required all state agencies to enter into consultation with tribes, but how that is defined has not been determined yet. So we're working with a tribal advisory committee and working on that language, and it hasn't been finished yet. So it's also important to note that we, as part of that policy, we must talk to both federally recognized and non-recognized tribes. Next slide. So the Moore Board defines a small community population of less than or equal to 20,000 persons with financial hardship based on the Public Resources Code Section 309.5A. Our official financial assistance also uses the MHI, the median household income, as we mentioned this morning. But that sometimes is limiting. Folks that need assistance may not be able to get it because they are constricted by definition or by rules that we have as to how we might give out money. We do tend to set aside money for disadvantaged communities in many of our grant programs. And we have a current one, an emergency drought program, DROPS, that is going to be giving money to schools, and we are talking about setting aside money specifically for disadvantaged region areas. So, one thing that folks should note is that a couple of years ago, the Human Right to Water legislation passed, and this AB685 applies to plans, policies, and funding priorities of state agencies. One of my challenges right now as the Environmental Justice Coordinator is to figure out how to implement that policy in the work that we do. So I will talk a little bit about that in a little bit. Another thing we're doing is working with tribal governments and environmental justice groups. In our Region 1, our North Coast Basin Plan, we have beneficial uses available to those folks are subsistence fish and cultural beneficial uses, but it is only in the Region 1 Basin Plan, nowhere else in the state. We are currently working with Felicia Marcus, our board chair, and tribal groups and environmental justice folks to talk about how we might modify that definition with some input from these groups and present it to the state board as a resolution in the coming months and have that tool available in our toolbox for regions to use as we move forward. So currently it doesn't exist except for Region 1. We're hoping to have that available statewide. So the first step would be to recognize this language, have it in a resolution, and then in the coming months, probably early next year, put it in some of our statewide plans, such as the statewide mercury policy, and see where we go from there. So the next slide, please. So since the WQCC last year, the State Board is continuing to do outreach. We have formed an EJ outreach roundtable. It's made up of mostly the AEOs, the Assistant Executive Officers from all the regions. We had our first meeting in May. We hope to have that meeting quarterly where we talk about issues statewide, whether it's for environmental justice, public participation, any challenges you might have, and work on possible solutions as we move forward with some of the folks that we assist. And as I said, the Human Right to Water analysis at the State Board, every time an item is coming before our board members, we are working with staff to do an analysis on how that item applies has considered the Human Right to Water and its implementation. And then, Hinckley, I continue to work with the staff at this region and the members of the community in Hinckley with their issues related to the cleanup of the town. We also have developed a regional controversial sites list. It lists items that could be of concern in the future. It's items that we want to watch. We have asked staff to help us prepare that.
things that maybe on the front page of the paper in the future, but we want to keep tabs of them. We want to make sure that we don't lose them. And if there are items of concern, then we keep tabs of that. And then we also, as part of the WPCC last year, developed an inventory of environmental justice projects and sites statewide. And so each region provided that information, and I can provide that to you if you don't need it. Next slide, please. So this is just a partial list of some of the EJ communities and tribes that the water boards have worked with. They're statewide. Some regions have more of a need than others. As we move forward, there are a lot of nitrate issues in the Central Valley. We will, with the most likely addition of the drinking water program to the water board in the coming weeks, I imagine that our work with disadvantaged communities, especially those in Central Valley, will increase. And so some of the conversations we had this morning on some of the challenges that are facing these communities will come up to the forefront. We'll have to figure these things out and how best to serve the folks that have the most need. Next slide, please. I was asked to present a little bit about some of our tribal efforts. As I said, we serve on the Calicay Tribal Advisory Committee. I'm the board's liaison for that. We have been assisting with California water plant updates through the Department of Water Resources. There was a recent California Water Plant Tribal Summit where we were participants, trying to work out some future solutions to some of the issues that tribes have. We do the quarterly Regional Tribal Operations Committee meetings where we present on various water quality programs and some of the work that the water boards do and make sure that tribes are fully aware. It's one of our opportunities for engagement with them. There is currently a UC Davis Tribal Fish Consumption Study as part of the methylmercury TMDL in the Central Valley region. A few years ago, it became evident that the fish consumption rates that were being used were not representative of what the tribes actually consumed. And so, as part of that, we embarked on a study to get better data. And so that is ongoing. It's almost done. I think that they have interviewed over 600 folks to gather information so that as we move forward, that will be available for future TMDL work. We, as I mentioned, consultation is something we need to think about as we move forward. When is it appropriate? How do we do it? How do we define it? So that policy, the Calicay policy, will give us some guidance on that. We maintain, our Office of Public Participation maintains tribal email lists of tribal chairs and environmental directors. We're in the process of updating that. It is one of the most robust lists within state agencies, so many folks use our list. But there is a lot of turnover, so we want to make sure it's as up-to-date as possible. There is an annual Native American Day at the Capitol, the fourth Friday in September. We participate in that. We have a booth. We provide information to anybody that comes. And typically, there's thousands of people that come to that. And then we are embarking on some training. A couple of years ago, we did do water rights training, California water rights for tribal governments so that they understand our water rights system. And various water quality programs are very interested in TMDLs and other things that they may have some input on. We will be doing that again, and not only for tribal governments, but also tribal sensitivity training for staff and board members that wish to get it, so that we understand some of the challenges that are being faced by tribal communities. So next slide, please. So some of the challenges we heard this morning, public participation, ability to attend meetings, ability to access information, participate in your primary language, access to a regional board, environmental justice contact persons with authority. That's one of the comments I got. Lack of representation on decision-making bodies. Folks want to be part of boards, part of stakeholder groups, part of the conversation. Capacity building. The lack of technical assistance with preparation of grant proposals. The lack of technical assistance to learn how to help maintain community water systems through occupational training. For example, a few years ago, we gave the community of San Gerardo some money to update their water, their infrastructure, but they didn't know what to do next. They needed help, and that is a challenge. Our Division of Financial Assistance had a technical assistance grant contract with the California Rural Water Association. It did expire. I need to get an update on that to see whether or not it has been extended and how folks might access that. At the time, it afforded 20 hours for a project to have some technical assistance. But we not only need to provide that, we also need to let people know it's available to them. Otherwise, it's no use. Next slide, please. Other challenges, administrative. As I said earlier, disadvantaged community environmental justice definitions can be limiting. If you don't fit the bill, you may not get the money. That could be a challenge. And many of the communities I work with, they may not fit the definition of a disadvantaged community, but they still have challenges in terms of environmental issues that impact them. And so they are, in essence, disadvantaged. Sometimes we use overly technical language. We need to speak the language that folks understand. Big funding issues. Often we're in isolated locations, less population based, but still have a need. The access to safe drinking water is, of course, an issue. Cumulative impacts, not only water, but other things that may affect these folks. A delayed reimbursement process. I heard earlier, you need a lot of startup money, and it's often difficult to get the funds after you put out the money to get reimbursed. It may take weeks or months. The TMF, the technical, managerial, and funding issues, the need for training, O&M, lack of effective outreach, how do we get certified operators in the areas, how do we build jobs in communities of need. Next slide, please. So this is the example of my controversial sites list. It's hard to read, but basically the region, the site name, where it is, a little bit of information about the issue. For Hinckley, it was the subject of the Aaron Brockovich film. The plume boundary is not yet contained. The groundwater has chromium 6 and other constituents. It has many complaints by the CalEPA online complaint system. Just an aside, my office also maintains this online complaint system. If you go to the Water Board's website or even the LPA's website, if you have an issue, if there's a spill or an impact to a water body, you can anonymously or use your name go in there and report that issue. If you click water, it goes to my office for triage. We send it out to the regional board that is the appropriate one to respond. So we keep track of that, but it is something that is maintained. One box that I want to add in the future is this a disadvantaged community? So, or a tribal community, for that matter. As I said, it's hard to read, but it helps to list it as something that we need to watch or keep tabs on as we move forward. And a little bit about some of the current status that Region 6 staff, led by the AEO, has driven to further communities, understanding some of the technical issues, public panel discussion on water supply, development of fact sheets, securing USGS assistance on manganese and other issues. So it gives a little bit of a synopsis of what's going on in the area. Next slide, please. So some of our tools and resources, this inventory of EJ actions, Cal EnviroScreen, which I believe Chuck will be mentioning in a second, we have a facilitation pool. The State Board maintains a group of staff that we have trained statewide that can help with facilitation of some of our conversations with folks. We have an in-house translation contract and in-house translation services. SB 965, a few years ago, required the state and regional boards to translate all of our agendas into Spanish. And so we have been doing that since January 1st, a couple of years ago. I have a staff person that is her sole job, is to translate agendas and other materials to assist the regions. And she does a bang-up job. This controversial sites list, our office has been helping with a lot of our major policy discussions. Nitrates is one of them. We had a nitrate report a few years ago, helping with some of the outreach. And we also have, as I said, the CalEPA tribal policy, the EJ strategy. We're working with U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to provide training for staff on environmental justice. I've had some conversations with them. They provided training to our Department of Toxic Substance Controls recently, and we will be providing that to staff and board members on what that is. And hoping also to work with community partners, with environmental justice groups, to help us understand better what some of the challenges are that they face. We want to strengthen our coordination with environmental justice tribal communities. We've had some EJ tours, environmental justice tours, Central Valley. We hope to have other tours in the future. We have a public participation manual available to staff. We also, those of you that work with us and may not understand fully what we are and who we are and what we do, we have a citizen's guide to working with California Water Boards. My office put that out a few years ago. It's a great resource. The online version is the most up-to-date with current laws on bag-making, et cetera. It's a great resource, and I encourage you to take a look at that tool. We continue to focus stakeholder outreach. It's something that our board members at the State Board are very interested in, especially for some of our statewide programs, the trash TMDL, the statewide mercury, desal. We've been having these focused outreach where we bring like-minded people together to tell us their concerns, and we listen to what they have to say before we even get to see what's going or move on with the project. We hear firsthand what some of the challenges are. And it seems to have been working very well. And as I mentioned, our ongoing work with on human right to water and how we might implement that in the work that we do. Next slide, please. So the next thing we need to do is do quarterly updates of that EJ inventory, provide this education and training, strengthen our coordination, continue our coordination with other agencies, offer training for anyone that needs it, and developing this framework regarding this type of consultation. And next, please. And that's it. So keep that with you to Chuck, unless you have questions.
Well, maybe take a minute here.
I know it's a lot to digest.
Yes, it does. Mr. Humphrey, do you have any questions or comments?
Not at this point, no.
Mr. Sandell?
Not yet, thank you.
No.
Okay, since there's so few people here, and this was such a massive amount of information, and we're all experts, I would like to open it to the floor to see if anybody from the audience has any comments or questions for Leah.
Can we ask if anyone does have comments to come up to the lectern so I can get them reported?
We need to know. Is there
Thank you very much for the great presentation. My name is Lisa Wallace, and I'm with the Truckee River Watershed Council in Truckee, California. And I have a question about the slide that's titled the PERSHA list of EJ communities.
Yes.
And how, so it appears that, for example, in Kern County, there's a mobile home park. And so what's the process for a group to, or a community to be recognized to be included?
This list is very, it's just a snapshot overview. There are many more communities that we work with, but too numerous to mention. And so, while they may not be on the list, they are definitely recognized, and folks that we do work with, I'm not sure if there's a current issue that you have with.
I'm thinking of one petition.
Sure. And so, the list is only meant as an overview of some of the communities we work with. By no means is it an all-encompassing list.
And would you suggest that we contacted your office or that we worked with the local regional water board staff or what would you
suggest? Okay. So if you have an issue, if you don't know who to go to, you can go to us first. We will then put you in touch with the right person. Or if you have developed that relationship, then by all means talk to them. Every year, every 3 years, we've been doing an environmental justice report to the legislature. So we want to make sure that we capture our successes as well, things that we've worked on, things that they should be aware of, and that's if there are things that are ongoing issues that are being worked out, it's something we do want to capture.
Great. Thank you.
very welcome. And as I said, you know, we heard a lot this morning about some of the challenges, and I think the important thing now is to take it to the next step and continue our dialogue, figure out how do we help these folks, how do we work through some of the challenges to make sure that technical assistance is available, funding mechanisms, you know, where do they go for that next step help? So,
Just let me make a quick comment. So, how many people on your staff?
That's the other. We are a small office with a shoestring budget that's sort of statewide. So, there's myself, Esther, my translation person, that's all she does, and one other person. So, there are three staff and myself serving statewide, which is why I'm never home. And yesterday morning, I was in Canada, personal family business, and then got home at 2 p.m., 3 p.m., I was on the road here. So there's a lot to be done with very little resources. I did, as one of my follow-ups to WBCP, was put in a BCP, a budget change proposal, proposing additional staff that could be distributed statewide. I'm not sure where it is in the process. I haven't been in the office, but I did hear that it's streamlined down, so it may be a total of three positions statewide in addition to my three in the office. So. It's not a lot. There's a tremendous need, so we need to further partner with folks out there because we can't do it all. So.
One of the comments I made at the WPCC meeting, and which I'm sure you agree with, given this massive amount of work that you've just laid out in front of us, is that this somehow has to get integrated into every program. Every program has to be responsible for this. I mean, it can't just be siloed in one office. Can't possibly deal with this with four people. So, and you know, with other regional boards, I know it's a real challenge. I think our board does a better job than most at trying to meet in times so where people can attend our meetings, to meet in places where people can attend our meetings, to accommodate different languages and things like that. A lot of the other regional boards are not as amenable as we are. And so there's a lot of education I can have to do with other regional boards.
Yes, there is. Yeah. And I often get challenged when I say, you need to meet after 6 p.m. or whatever the issue is. And I get pushback. No, we'll meet at 5. And, you know, and then it looks like we're not listening to the communities that we serve. And it's unfortunate, but they don't always listen. So.
On page 4, the student guidance, how do we also work with our community in college? Within Alpine County, up in Lake Palmer, and Broward County, there's a large divide of Nevada and California.
Yes.
Are they eligible for funding?
One of the things we are doing in the coming weeks, I have a staff person that's working on a funding brochure for tribal governments so they understand what funding resources may be available to them. Unfortunately, different pots of money have different rules and regulations. Some federal money may not be available to non-federally recognized tribes, etc. So we're working on providing that information in the coming weeks. Yes.
Gita, do other Cali PA boards have similar environmental justice or office of participation?
Do they have a me?
Yes.
Some do, some don't. Some have more than one person. So in my counterpart at DTSC, there is both an environmental justice person and also a tribal liaison. Some have one person that kind of does it. Not many are the ombudsman and all these other things. And most of them don't have a technical background.
And then what about other agencies? Like
outside of the Cali PA, the Resources Agency, Department of Water Resources, they have a tribal liaison that has been working with me and others on the drought response, on the tribal calls, etc. And then Cali PA has a tribal liaison, someone that was appointed a few years ago. Cynthia Gomez used to be the undersecretary at for tribal affairs at Cali PA. So it's hit or miss,
and Natural Resources has come out with a tribal policy, but it's very generic and doesn't really have a lot of specificity. Ours is taking a little longer, but hopefully will give us better guidance on what consultation means.
I may.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Mark. Follow up to your question. Are you differentiating EJ communities relative to disadvantaged communities? And if so, what are the criteria that you use for designation for the EJ relative to the DAC?
I was talking to Holly earlier on this, and disadvantaged communities, there are definitions. They may not work in all instances, whether it's median household income or whatever. Environmental justice, I think, is a fair treatment of everybody. So they're not necessarily the same thing, and I think it's a nuanced thing, and it means different things to different people. I serve anyone with a need, and you know, whether it's an affluent or a semi affluent community in Los Angeles that has homes on a previous underground tank facility, or whether it's a small group in East LA. I mean, it just doesn't really matter. We both have the same problems, where they've got health issues, they've got contamination below, their property values have gone down. It doesn't really matter. They still need help in understanding what remedies may be available to them.
It's sort of a follow-up question.
Sure.
There are certain benefits, ironically, if you
sure.
will, about
being labeled.
Being right. So,
sure.
Relative to DAC, I appreciate the point of you can be an affluent
yeah.
community. So, are there criteria that you would have yeah. to that designates a community as EJ
sure.
and therefore
so,
benefit?
So, our Division of Financial Assistance has a community water strategy where they have defined, and I believe it's based on median household income. There's criteria. If you fit this criteria, then you're eligible for money. And the coronavirus screen, they're hoping that this tool will help to define areas that are more severely impacted statewide in the top 10%, and then perhaps funding opportunities could go to those areas. So, you know, there is more of a cognizant attitude of helping those with the most need based on certain criteria. So as we move forward with these conversations, I think that there is a recognition that there are folks that are more impacted than others. So,
thank you.
Does that help? Okay.
Hey, it hurts. Thank you.
Thank you, Dina. Dr. Hunter, members of the board, again, I'm Chuck Curtis with the Water Board. Next slide, please. As Gina indicated, environmental justice is the fair treatment of all people, regardless of race, culture, or income level, in all the work that we do. Next. So in the Lahaina region, many of our communities and residents are economically disadvantaged, which is defined as a median household income of 80% of the statewide median household income. Enclosure 1 in your agenda packet listed nearly 50 communities in our region that are identified as an economically disadvantaged community. Some of those are identified here. Next slide, please. Lahaina region also includes many Native American communities, as well as Native American people that don't live in a recognized tribal community. This slide shows the federally recognized tribes in our region, and as I said, there are also many tribes and tribal members in our region that aren't currently in a federally recognized tribe, that we should consider them, their situation, in the work that we do, and bringing those into participating in what we do and considering those in how we how we work with that community. Next. So in addition to the economically disadvantaged and tribal communities in our region, many of our communities are small and rural, and those characteristics pose their own unique challenges in obtaining safe, affordable drinking water and wastewater disposal, in obtaining government services, and in making their voices heard concerning agency decisions that may affect their lives. A tool that agencies such as the Oahana Water Board and partner organizations can use for identifying communities that may require extra assistance to ensure fair treatment is the Office of Environmental Hazard Health Hazard Assessment, or EHA. It's their Cal Environmental Screening Program. It's available on their website. Just go to the OEHA. .ca.gov website, and you can find a link for it there. And this tool identifies those communities that are more affected by pollution and other stressors, such as low employment, high unemployment, and similar. With this tool, areas can be identified that could especially benefit from environmental restoration. For example, through the use of our supplemental environmental project programs or grant funding for clean water for other services. Next, please. Here's an example of the environmental screening program's output with an area extending from near Victorville through Barstow. Those areas with the darker colors are identified as being subject to more pollution and more other environmental stressors. Thanks. Well, Oahana Water Board and staff implement environmental justice in many ways, as indicated on this and the next slide. We support the integrated regional water management groups in their efforts to protect watersheds and provide coordinated management of surface and groundwaters for use by all. We'll hear more about early group activities after I'm done. As was mentioned by Dr. Horn, this board holds its meetings in those areas where the community members are most affected by its decisions. That's definitely considering how that's an environmental justice measure, and I agree with Dr. Hunt, it's a very good one. As Gita indicated also, we provide Spanish translation where that's appropriate. We've been providing assistance to tribes in water quality planning, for these federally recognized tribes. Many of them have decided to embark on their own sovereign laws regarding water quality protection, water use, and we've provided assistance, I know, to Bishop Pine Tribe and to others regarding that. We also provide, we have a significant relations with the Washoe Tribe related to the Leviathan Mine Project. The Leviathan Mine is a former sulfur mine in Alpine County that impacts a couple of streams that run through tribal allotments and through the tribal community. So they're very, very much impacted by that mine site, and they're very engaged in the process associated with that. Next, please. As I said earlier, we've worked with official pilot, we're working with them right now to better understand the source of bacteria in its waters and how those might be addressed. Other ways that we implement environmental justice is, for example, in our enforcement actions, we consider the size and economic situation of communities and people and businesses that we come in contact with during our enforcement activities to consider their ability to pay fines and continue the business. In summary, economic or environmental justice, fair treatment, regarding environmental justice, fair treatment for all who interact with the Water Board is not about treating everyone equally. It's about treating everyone fairly, considering their unique situation. This applies to the Water Board's decisions, the regulations and policies of the Water Board. It applies to how board staff implement those regulations and policies. We should continue and we should expand where possible, promoting public participation in working with staff as well as the Water Board. And the Water Board holds its meetings once a month, eight times a year or so roughly. Water Board staff interact with disadvantaged communities daily. And we have an opportunity to assist those communities and those individuals in understanding our regulations, in identifying those opportunities that may be available to them. And so there are many ways that the staff and the board interact with disadvantaged communities and other communities that have challenges that may not fit any given definition of an economically disadvantaged or disadvantaged community. So I think that we have a lot of opportunity, and I think there's a lot of work that we need to do. I believe that there's a lot of training of staff that some of that has started. I know that I've participated in tribal cultural issues training, and some of our other staff have started to become involved in these, and there's a lot more to do. And I think we're heading in the right direction, and I'm very proud of this board for its efforts related to environmental justice. With that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Mark Drew and Paul Albert of the Indiana-Mono Regional Water Management Group. Holly Albert will be giving a presentation regarding their efforts associated with this community.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having us and giving us the opportunity to speak again today. Many of you have already heard much of this presentation, but I hope it will give us more opportunity to think about these concepts and mull over them a little bit more. While I have 20 miles, I want to thank Sue and the staff and the board for letting us use this facility during the day today. I think it was really a perfect match, and we're just thrilled with how the conference went today. So thank you for being part of it. I also do want to recognize and introduce Dr. Mark Drew. He's the program manager of our Indiana-Mono IRWM program, and I'm the manager, program director, and I'm the program manager. So we've been working closely together on this for about 6 years now. So what I want to talk about tonight, again, for some cases, is about the work that we've been doing through our Disadvantaged Communities Grant that we got through the California Department of Water Resources. And And this grant is part of the large pool of interregional funding that the Department of Water Resources set aside through Prop 84 IRWM money for regions to work interregionally. A lot of that money went to other places, but what they did is pulled out a section of that money, about $2.5 million, specifically to have IRWM regions work with disadvantaged communities, and even more specifically to really look into how to best engage and get disadvantaged communities, including tribes, involved in IRWM planning. The Department of Water Resources made these grants available originally to 5 regions that are now available. They're now in 7 IRWM regions, and they're all over the state. So it's everybody from us, we're here on the east side, that's very rural and isolated, to more agricultural regions, to more urban regions. So the goal is statewide, and we're going to learn a whole lot more about disadvantaged community engagement in regional water planning. And I'm certainly hoping, especially after working with the board today, that this will be applicable to more than just DWR. That will be applicable certainly to the state board, if not also the regional board. Oh, here we go.
Sorry.
That's okay. Luckily, I have that first slide memorized. So a little bit about the region real quick, and then I go back to the disadvantaged communities. There's a map of our region. We're sort of in the center of it right now, Bishop. It's always nice to talk to audiences that are familiar with the east side already. Where our IRWM region is a big region. It's about 11% of the state of California, over 50% of the Lahontan regional core region, but what's also the DWR funding region. We have a fairly small population that's concentrated in the major population centers that also makes for a very sparsely populated area, about 4 people per square mile. We love the topography that we live in. We have mountains, deserts, saline lakes. Another major feature of our region is that we export quite a bit of water. We serve up to about 1 million of LA's residents with water from the Inyomon region. Next slide. So I covered this already. That's the list of regions that actually has the grants now. Most of these are going to be finishing up by the end of the summer. So we're really going to start seeing what the results of these grants are and hopefully get DWR, but also helping the state be looking at the results statewide and what this really means for the bigger IRWM program. Next slide, please. The specific Inyomono DAC grant is really targeted to a rural, sparsely populated headwaters region. We think that the information we're gathering and that we examined will really fill that niche. Again, some of those other regions also are rural, may have sparsely populated areas. So we hope to work with them and think about, are we finding similar things through these grants? Without going through the entire objectives, and you have these, you can read them on your own, but we're looking at what are the most effective ways of identifying and defining disadvantaged communities? What are the most effective ways of outreaching to disadvantaged communities? And can we understand the barriers and obstacles preventing DACs from participating in these regional water management groups? We're also very interested in looking at policies from state, regional, local levels that encourage or inhibit DAC participation in these regional groups. We started this grant about 3 years ago. We'll have a final draft to DWR by the end of September. And that draft will, of course, be made available to anybody interested, but we'll probably do some kind of formal rollout sending to various agencies. Next slide, please. And my voice is going after talking so much today. This is the definition of a DAC. Chuck, thank you for providing this already in our numbers of review, so I was glad to see that. One additional note here is there's also a level of disadvantaged community that is a severely disadvantaged community, and that's a community with an MHI, meaning household incomes, of 60% or less of the California statewide MHI. So I'll be talking about that a little bit. In the Inyomono region, we've done the analysis of how many disadvantaged communities there are of the population centers that we have, and we use both the Census Bureau data and also American Community Survey data to pull MHI and understand what communities are disadvantaged. And I'll be talking about some problems with that with the next slide. But on this slide, we figured out that at least half of our population centers in the region are disadvantaged. Of those, 15 communities are severely disadvantaged communities, including the majority of the tribes that occur in the region that we work with quite closely. So we know that it's a big problem for the region. On a county level, we also know that the entirety of Mineo County is considered disadvantaged based on its income. Although that doesn't always work for funding purposes, as we found out. The major industries in the region that I think are no secret to probably the larger Lahontan region, tourism, agriculture, some resource extraction, still, these are unpredictable industries, and they tend to fluctuate. So that's probably what contributes to the disadvantage of these towns. Next slide. So here's the big box. The difficulty with identifying these disadvantaged communities is especially for, at least that we found, especially for rural regions, these census or American Community Survey data may be incomplete, just not available at all for some towns. So we've had a couple of different discrepancies that we've looked at. One is the second bullet here, where the census geography, such as a census designated place, may not always match up with what we're calling communities of interest, such as a water district board or a fire protection district, where it makes sense to think about what's the income of a certain part of the town. So an example here is, in this map at the inset, that larger orange polygon is the census-designated place of Big Pine, California, which is 15 minutes away. According to the American Community Survey, the CDP of Big Pine is not disadvantaged. It has a higher income than that median household income threshold. The smaller green polygon is the boundary of the Big Pine Community Services District, whom a lot of you met today. And that's really the community of interest in Big Pine. They may want to go for a grant to improve their water system. But in order to prove that they're a DAC, they would need to probably get a special community-specific income survey to prove what their MHI is just for those boundaries. Those surveys, as we heard today, may or may not be available for free, but the ones that we know that have been done in the region have tended to be fairly expensive. So those are a couple of the discrepancies. The data may not be available, we may not be at the scale that we're really interested in. And then an overarching question that he was also getting at is the 80% MHI threshold even the best definition to use for a disadvantaged community? And I'll be getting into that as we go a little bit further. Next slide, please. So we've been thinking about, through this grant, are there better ways of defining and identifying DACs? It might be in addition to median household income, or it might be finding a substitute or a suite of substitute for MHI data. So what we did is we started thinking about what are the communities in the region, what do they look like, what are some of the characteristics that might indicate whether they're disadvantaged or not. And we literally did a lot of driving through the towns in our region and did a lot of observations and picture taking. So we would compare a couple of communities that we know to be disadvantaged or not disadvantaged. And in a non-DAC, we see bigger houses, often two stories, probably some landscaping, fairly tight yard. And then we drive through some of the DACs in the region, and we see smaller houses, often one story, maybe a lot of mobile homes, often cars that may not look like they were, maybe they were, but it's not so obvious from the observer's point of view. A lot of chain link fences, which I think is really interesting, and maybe not so much landscaping. So we took these observations and we actually developed a survey on the next slide, where we could go through communities and collect some information about the community that might help us give a sense of its level of disadvantage. We we collected both community level information, things like, I think you mentioned it a bit, is there a fire station in town? Is there a police station? How far is it to the nearest emergency medical services? Or even the nearest bank or the nearest school? And then we collected property level information, some of those things I talked about with the photos. What kind of house is it? Is it one story, two story? Is it a mobile home? What does the property look like? Is there landscaping? And so we did this for 14 communities total. The communities in white are those for which we have MHI data from the census or the ACS. And then we did this for four communities that are more, they're either these communities of interest that we're talking about, like water district boundary, or census geographies that just don't have any data available. So what we were hoping to do is sort of match up what we're collecting in the community with median household income information and start finding a potential substitute. So we took a lot of these different indicators and started playing around a lot with graphing software and statistics and really just ran a bunch of regressions. Next slide. Here's one result we came up with, which so far we have found is the best fit. And this is percentage of single-story homes in the community regressed against median household income on the y-axis. And of those different kinds of information we collected, this was the best fit for predicting median household income. So the way this works is the larger percentage single-story homes in the community, the more likely it is to be a disadvantaged community and have a lower income. So we thought this was really interesting. We don't think it's the full story. We think there's more to it. Like I said, this was the best fit in terms of the information we were collecting, but we think there's other information that can be collected, and there's probably other ways to continue doing this analysis as well. So the last step we took with this, next slide, was to use that particular regression that we just showed and try to come up with estimated MHI values for those four communities for which we did not have MHI. So we took the percentage single-story homes that we had collected out in the field, and we used the equation from the previous regression and actually came up with a series of estimated MHI. For three of these communities, Big Pine, McGee Creek, and Rovana, we felt the estimates were fairly reasonable from what we know about the communities. Bridgeport ended up being an interesting case study because they had an income survey done for the Public Utilities District because they are looking at going for different grants for which being designated as a DAC would help. Their survey came out with about $41,000 and our estimate was $58,000. So not only does it not make it DAC, but it's just wildly different. So again, this is the first step. I don't think we've solved it, but we think there's something in here that's interesting that we want to keep exploring. Next slide. So the take-homes from this is that we know there are data gaps, particularly in rural areas. We're looking for information indicators that we can collect on the ground to help fill in these missing data sets. And looking for ways to collect data right in the community so that we can help to fill in those data sets and not necessarily rely on data from somewhere else that may not be fully available. Again, we think this is an exercise that's useful for rural headwaters regions. This exercise might be very different in a more urban, densely populated area. And as I said, it's not complete. We want to keep going with some of this analysis. We encourage others to keep going with this analysis. If somebody wants to take it off the board and left off, we'd be happy to let them. Next slide. I'm also going to run through a couple of slides on other parts of this DDC project that we did, not in as much detail as I gave this morning, but just to let you know sort of the breadth of the activities that were part of this project. Really, the major focus of the DAC project was the outreach. So again, we were looking at good ways to outreach to DACs, what worked, what didn't work, and how to really work to get them involved in these IRWM regions. We held a lot of formal meetings in the region. We held a few public meetings where we invited anybody in the community to come talk about the water issues, often healthies at night in a center just like this, didn't get great participation. So we found that the one-on-one meetings with individual DACs, tribes, water systems were a lot more successful. We learned a lot more. I think we were able to see a lot more across also about the IRWM concept. Part of our outreach was also meeting with IRWM groups and DACs outside of our IRWM region, especially in other rural headwaters-type regions, because we wanted to understand, are you dealing with similar issues with DACs and tribes? Are they very different? Are we seeing commonalities over rural headwaters regions? Are we completely different on the east side? And again, I'm not going to go into some of the results of that like I did this morning, but the bottom line is, yeah, there are a lot of common issues. But at the same time, we know that each IRWM region has its specific concerns. A lot of the common issues had to do with being rural headwaters regions, not having access to resources, exporting a lot of water, and wanting downstream water users to understand where the water is coming from. And then finally, we found that some of the venues we were a part of as part of the DAC grant were really unexpected, nicely unexpected outreach opportunities. Like some of the trainings I'll talk about in a minute, we participated in some community events like World Water Day, and it really gave us an opportunity to interact with individual community members that may not be a part of their water system, but to just kind of get to know the community as a whole. Next slide, please. Another big part of what we did through the DAC grant was to assess needs of DACs and start working on building capacity. And since he's in the room, I'd like to recognize Dustin Hardwood from the California Rural Water Association. They work with us on these needs assessments and were hugely, hugely helpful. Dustin actually had staff go out to 17 DAC water systems, meet with them individually, spend time with them talking about the water system, talking about some of the ways that they're currently meeting their needs, but maybe some ways that they're also deficient in meeting their needs. And what we came up with after looking at all 17 of those systems are some themes that came out that then we can use to think about how do we start bringing resources to these water systems. So some of the big themes were operating plans, missing operating plans. A lot of these systems didn't have water conservation plans, five-year budgets, maybe not even one-year budgets. Capital improvement plans were, I think, a big deficiency among these systems. So again, we were able to take this information and start asking, okay, what can we do now to bring these resources? And if you go to the next slide, we did this largely through a series of trainings. Again, World Water Association provided the majority of the trainings. We provided some of them in-house through the Irwin, and they were targeted at DACs, but anybody was welcome to come. We provided these at no cost. We tried to provide them at convenient days, times, locations throughout our very large region. And we also, especially with Dustin's trainings, we were able to provide continuing education credit to water managers and water operators, and that was huge. That really boosted our attendance, so very helpful. And so here are some of the topics that we covered. We did in-house grant writing, mapping, and then Dustin's group did all of those others, utility management on down. And we got really good feedback from these trainings, that they were very helpful, that water systems would like to see these offered again and again through the region. So that's something we're thinking about for the future. Next slide, please. As, again, many of you heard this morning, we're coming up with a series of recommendations, specifically in this case to take to the Department of Water Resources because it's their grant, but we're hoping these recommendations can be useful for other state agencies, for regional boards, for other IRWM groups. And again, these will all be available publicly. I'm not going to go into them in as much detail this evening, but some of these include: we need to recognize that this band community outreach takes time, it takes persistence, it may take repeated meetings, and especially specific knowledge about the communities in which you're working. It's important to utilize these unlikely outreach venues, such as public meetings or other kinds of community events that happen. We intend to, and we would suggest, continued research on the this concept of finding a different kind of definition or maybe a more holistic definition for disadvantaged communities. Next slide, please. We'd like to see the state especially keep promoting the training and capacity building of disadvantaged communities through trainings, technical assistance, and this can be done at various levels, but I think that having the state really encouraging this would help support or promote support of that throughout the IRWM regions. We're looking at creating a recommendation around having a different or maybe reduced requirements for grant proposals and grant administration for DACs. Again, this is targeted at the DWR program, but I think we'd like to look into this a little bit more and think about how widespread this recommendation could be. We think it's important, especially in regions like ours, to look at possibilities of water system consolidation. Obviously, in a sparsely populated region, there may not be a whole lot of opportunity, but, for example, Bishop has about 40 water systems, and some of those are adjacent, and they're all being run separately. So is there an opportunity to create some efficiency of scale? And then finally, we really like both the state and local areas to look at water rate structures. We see a lot in this region that water users are being charged fairly unrealistic rates, given the true cost of delivering, treating water, providing operation maintenance costs, and also capital improvement. So that's something we're going to be looking into quite a bit more, I think. Next slide, please. So what's next? We just submitted these draft recommendations to DWR a couple days ago, but after the input that we got today, which was fantastic, we're going to be doing, I think, a lot of work with these recommendations, expanding the ones we have, I think expanding the numbers. For those who didn't see earlier today, we have a brand new documentary about disadvantaged communities in our region. We're very happy to show it today. We got to show it for the first time last week. It will eventually be available on our website. We hope to really publicize it as much as we can. We're doing quite a few presentations like this to various entities presenting the results of this work. We'll submit a final report to DWR, and then we fully intend to keep doing what we're doing. We may be out of funding to do it, but find a way to continue working with DACs and tribes in the region, and even continuing to reach out to those that we really haven't established relationships with yet. And there are a few entities still. And even today's workshop, we made some first contacts, so even today was really successful. And then we'd like to continue to look into these regional and state-level policies and legislation that relate to the DACs, relate to the human right to water. We think there's still a lot of opportunity. It's not that everybody's recognizing that. A lot of opportunity to keep doing this. Next slide. So thank you again for giving us the opportunity to be here. Happy to take questions. I'm happy to pass them on.
Let's see if any board members have questions. Is your voice going to hold up?
I'm okay. Okay. I'm good.
I need some water here.
Okay. Mr. Humphrey?
I seem to think that I'm waiting until all the presentations.
I just have one question. On the rate structures question, when you mentioned the cost of making sure the water's of good quality for its local water, is the reason it's not potable, is it for natural reasons or is there pollution? And if it's pollution, then suggest to me that there might be a role for increased penalties as opposed to raising rates for cleaning up water.
Yeah, that makes sense. By and large, the smaller, more disadvantaged systems that we're working with that have had contamination problems, it's coming from natural sources in the groundwater, mostly arsenic and uranium. They're required to deal with that, obviously, through regulations. Again, most of those smaller DACs are groundwater dependent, but I might actually turn it over to Mark. Are there any surface, do you think of any systems with surface water contaminants that might be pollution based.
There may be sporadic or episodic events type of thing, but mostly it's a groundwater, primarily natural occurring contamination.
Any other questions in the audience? Or
I have a couple of just to follow up.
Sure. Mark.
One is an encouragement for us to keep moving forward. I think our current administration in Sacramento is working hard. With your support, we're beginning to see change. In 2009, we have the Human Rights to Water Act that was passed in the House, the government didn't pass it off. 2012 was passed. There have been a multitude of bills that have been passed since 2011 that support vulnerable communities or disadvantaged communities with respect to meeting water needs. It's in the State Water Action Plan, explicitly in various strategies to address and support vulnerable and or disadvantaged communities. The time is now. We've got momentum. We need to figure out how to work with you, DWR, Cal EPH, and other entities to solve this problem. It's not something that can be done in 2-3 years with a single plan. There's an investment that we all need to be committed to. We were very lucky to get this grant. It was 1 of 7. It came out of a pool of money. We were fortunate to be in the right place at the right time and be able to say, we want to do this, we can do it, help us do it. That comes to an end in a few months. We don't have another source of money to help these types of programs move forward. For the Indian Mono program in particular, we have been looking at things not so much as let's find a band-aid, fix the water system, okay, we're done, but why do we do outreach? We want to figure out what are the sort of problems that we need to be addressing. And then we turn to partners to help us identify what those needs are and what are the strategies and actions that we need to be taking to move forward. And then we need to move forward on securing funding to address those. And we're not going to be able to really do this without bigger, broader collaboration. So we encourage and thank you all for being here to work with us and allow us to engage as much as we possibly can, not only in these sorts of venues, but are there opportunities when grant programs are being considered to engage with representatives from the Greater Fishmonger Management Programs who are really the people that are on the ground interacting with the communities, so that we can help, really. It's how do we help one another solve the problems? And I'd love to be able to have further discussions about how do we tap resources that you all are aware of, that you all may be able to support with, not only for hard projects, but for capacity building. Let's don't take someone fishing, let's teach you how to fish. So that we're not here in 5 years saying, okay, we still have this problem, let's figure out how to build the capacity so that these people, these communities have become self-sufficient. And then we're waning dependence on state agencies, particularly scarce resources by local governments. Thank you.
Thank you very much again for having us.
Thank you, Holly. I'd like to introduce Kirby Drillmore from the Mojave Water Agency and the Mojave Water Resource.
Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the board. Patty, thank you for the invitation to come and chat with you. I'm going to be talking, first of all, my name is Kirby Grohl. I'm the General Manager of Mojave Water Agency, but I'm really here representing the Mojave Integrated Regional Water Management Group, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. Before I get into it, you're going to see some common themes of what you just what you just heard from our sister integrated group. Very similar experiences. This is, before I start with the next slide, this is our second integrated plan. We began our first one in 2001 or so. We ended up adopting a plan, really finishing around 2004. Much different flavor this time around, for a couple of reasons, that I'll get into. Want to go ahead and advance? One of the differences in our first plan back in 2004, we didn't have an outreach component. But I think this time around it was much more aggressive, much more intensive, and maybe even more importantly, much more intimate in the way we set it up and the places we've been. And so here's kind of an area of our majority of our integrated water management plan area. It's all of Mojave Water Agency plus a little bit. Mojave Water Agency is about, our area is about 5,000 square miles, so I'm guessing probably the integrated plan area is probably close to six. You can see there that most of the area that was referenced earlier is meets the disadvantaged community categories. You can see a number of different dots, yellow and green. We work very closely with our consulting team, but we also utilize a lot of Mojave Water Agency staff and quite frankly, other volunteers that were part of the Integrated Regional Water Management Group to hold these meetings. And they were highly productive. We learned a heck of a lot. Next slide, please. A little bit hard to read, but again, all the detail isn't really necessary here. This is essentially a matrix that helped prioritize objectives that the integrated group came up with. On one axis is urgency, on the other is important. So there may be something that has a high importance but a low urgency. There's obviously things that have high urgency, high importance. Go ahead and click. The one that came out of this process, and again, you think of an integrated water management group that's a broad base of different profiles. So cities, water districts, homeowners associations, environmental groups, representatives from your agency, all getting together and discussing this very diverse set of potential objectives. With that, there was a general recognition that the needs that were identified through this process of disadvantaged communities rose to the top in both urgent and importance. There's a number of reasons for this. And the probably the biggest reason that came to light, again, now we're moving into the common themes, the lack of local capacity, the lack of available capacity. One story came to mind as I was listening to the presentations earlier that I witnessed personally. There was one small system in one small community. It's a water system. I can't remember how many it was, 15, 20, less than 50 connections. And the person that was running that water system was someone that was essentially volunteered by that community, a former librarian. I think this is sometimes very, very typical. There's a series of small connections. Various homeowners, they're trying to make it work, and they're doing the best they can, but really they don't have the tools. And in talking to her, there were financial challenges, there were budget challenges, there's new water quality regulations that are coming down, there's financial challenges, and really she didn't know where to turn. And was just very kind of frustrated, if you will, of, again, being volunteered by her neighbors to run the system, not having any knowledge, any tools to do it. And we found that this was very typical throughout our input process. So this was identified in the group. All these stories were brought together, and the integrated group says, yes, this is something that's very important. We want to do something about it. How do we go about doing it? That kind of was the next challenge. Next slide, please. Go ahead, click through. Yeah. We recognize that there seemingly wasn't a lot of tools available to us. From the Mojave Water Agency standpoint, we don't do small water systems. It's foreign to us. It's not our core competency. We don't have that level of expertise among staff. It's not what we do. Much more familiar with big systems. I think you may know that we're one of the 29 state water contractors, so we do wholesale, we do large management programs, conservation programs, groundwater management, all those things, but we don't understand small systems. So we have a board that is very interested in pursuing this. We have an identified objective by the integrated group, and it was generally recognized lack of potential tools. Very quickly, we realized that there was a presence in our area, probably not as much as it could be, but that presence was already by the Cal Rural Water Association, who we've already referred to a representative over here in our audience, Dustin Hardwick. was already working with many of these folks that we heard from. Next slide, please. In fact, this is the list that were already members of. There were 22 identified in our service area. There were 7 additional that were identified in the integrated plan area, but they were outside of our service area. So there were a number of already existing members. So then we opened up a dialogue with CalROL, and we very quickly recognized that there was very limited amount of funding for them to do what they do. So one of the concepts that we had was not only with the integrated group, but also with the Mojave Water Agency, was to explore this partnership. We never worked with CalROL. We never worked with small water systems, for that matter. And so this was all brand new to us. Next slide, please. So we started dating. Back in 2003, we entered into really what we referred to as a pilot. I forget what the amount was, but I think it was like $25,000 or $30,000 to begin developing the potential framework of a partnership. And we focused on a couple of different things. We already had a couple of communities that came to us with some kind of urgent concerns, and we wanted to work with them. We also had some other communities, other small water systems, that kind of had identified this need for training. So we set out to do a couple of training sessions with a limited amount of funds, and we also set out to do some grant applications in communities where there were no water systems, but there was some interest of potentially creating one. Now, that's a whole other niche, too, that many of our parts of our service area are on individual wells, and for example, the community that you're all very familiar with in Hinckley, is that they're not that unique. Maybe unique in the having a movie developed around them, but not unique in some of the challenges they face. So we have some small communities that have small water systems, 10, 20, a couple hundred, others that have none, and there's kind of a varying level of needs and interest across the board. So anyways, so we identified the potential partnership with CalROL. We entered into this, what we call kind of a pilot relationship, if you will, and started working through and seeing if there was really something there to work with. Go ahead. Some of the products or some of the things that we did when we conducted 9 needs assessments. You heard from those earlier. And there was 3 additional workshops focused on different water-related. The attendance exceeded our expectations. They were very widely attended. Matter of fact, a couple of them had waiting lists, and we had to open up additional workshops to try to capture those that we weren't able to serve in the first round. In addition, there were some applications that were submitted to CDPH for financial assistance, and these included the Soap Mine Road and the Hinckley area. Soap Mine Road, you're probably familiar with. That's the part of the perchlorate issues that was that kind of came to light a couple of years ago, and obviously the Hinckley. Next slide, please. These are just those applications that were submitted, and both of these applications, again, were around the pre-planning and legal entity formation. Is it even possible, is it even feasible to develop a some sort of community water system? Okay, next one. That's the Hinckley one. Go ahead. Again, multiple system assessments on the grant applications, training classes, again, available with capacity and waiting list. Okay, next. There's a kind of a view of all the small water systems. Again, I think the definition of a small water system is less than 3,000 connections. And as you saw earlier, most, if not, I think most of these are within disadvantaged community areas. Next slide, please. Here's kind of a blow up in one portion of our area, the Southern Valley, to kind of show you. I don't think we quite have quite as many in this area as stuff like the Bishop may have, but same concept. A lot of these sporadic small water systems kind of operating independently, and yes, also in this area there were identified the potential for consolidation or potential for interconnections. Again, this is it would be presumptuous for us to look at a map and say a community needs this, and what's really needed is going into the community, put boots on the ground, so to speak, and really talk one-on-one with these water systems and these representatives and find out what their needs are, and then really, based on that, develop a plan. Okay, next slide, please. Most recently, we must have liked our dating experience. There was a suggestion, request by the Integrated Plan Committee that I'm going to talk to you about in just a moment to seek at least some initial financial commitment from the Mojave Water Agency. There was $200,000 budgeted just, I think, a week ago. We got board authorization to execute agreement for this coming fiscal year to support expansion of this pilot in partnership with CalRural. And the board did authorize $200,000 for the next fiscal year to do needs and corporate compliance assessment, training, assistance with application, and it also included, very importantly, a part-time manager, again, that boots on the ground. Again, this is CalRural's expertise, at least that's what we're finding, but they are very much limited with their resources, so it was very important to identify actual people that can get out there and talk with people, talk with our constituents, understand their needs, and really to configure a program around those needs. Next slide, please. This is tied in very closely with our integrated plan. Matter of fact, there was actually a formal small water system subcommittee with a charter that was developed, a formal charter that's a component of the integrated plan. And you won't recognize it, may not recognize any of the names there, but one you will, Dustin Hardwick was CalRural's representative. But these are various representatives of kind of a leadership team, if you will, of our integrated plan. And there's a couple there representing small water systems. Others are just they're very interested in engaged community members. There's a couple of staff, water agency staff that they're spending that aren't on there that are very interested in seeing this program go forward. They're very interested in implementing various components of the integrated plan. So there's a strong formal tie back to the integrated plan. And the next slide, I believe, shows kind of how it works together. This shows the kind of the relationship with Mojave Water Agency and small water systems. Again, as I mentioned, this is something we don't do. But the idea would be that we're supporting integrated plan goals. The prime contact and the boots on the ground, so to speak, would be CalRural. Mojave Water Agency would support that as much as we can technically and with the limited financial resources that are authorized. There's kind of arrows going both ways on that. There's a green arrow going down, there's an arrow coming back. And go ahead and flip to the next. The hope is that there's outside monies coming in and that the investment that can be made can be returned and then be made again, if you will, by some of these grant applications. And again, the focus here, I guess there's a couple of focus, I think that were part of the concluding remarks that Mark made, is that it's not just about building stuff, building pipes, building treatment plants. If you throw money at stuff and you don't have the local capacity, that stuff isn't going to, it's not going to be maintained, it's not going to be operated properly. So there's really kind of both of those that are needed, but be very cautious of just throwing money at pipes and reservoirs. So a large part of this really initially is we'll be really focused on the capacity building. But with hopes that as we grow our capacity and as these small water systems become more and more capable, they'll be ready for the larger investments and hopefully some of the state policies and continue where some of those monies can be made available. Next slide, please. I guess that's it. If there's any questions.
Board members?
I don't have questions, but I have a couple comments, whenever that's... I was right, I did run away from the
expect you to probably go ahead with comments.
Well, in the days leading up to this meeting, I hope that at some point I'd be able to say something coherent about this topic. I'm not sure that I'm going to achieve that goal, but one of the things that's difficult about being on a board like this is that things come before you and you look at them and you think, God, that's so self-evident and clearly obvious that I wonder why it is that we're re-dealing with this topic. To me, it doesn't take a lot of rocket science to understand that you want to build in an institutionalized fairness into the things that you do. And I guess it's a sad commentary that it isn't self-evident to everybody else. And so we have to deal with that. But I think it's important to distinguish in the distinction that Ida and Mr. Curtis made between environmental justice and this concept of fairness and disadvantaged communities, because they're not the same category of things. Fairness is fairness, and it's fair for it to apply to everybody. But you can be a disadvantaged community for a variety of reasons. You can have these needs because of conditions of unfairness, or you can have these because of conditions that happen to be where you are. Or you could be disadvantaged because of lack of financial resources, but also just due to a lack of critical mass, not being big enough to matter enough, to be eligible enough, to plan correctly or have the resources to operate what you're charged with doing. And what's disturbing to me is that as time goes on, the world seems to spin farther and farther away from the small operation, a small community, and so they become more and more isolated because they have fewer and fewer resources on a relative basis. Part of the issue, I think, is access to resources outside the community, and I really am thinking of resources in Sacramento in terms of in Washington, in terms of financial resources, expertise. So part of the process is trying to get access to those resources, to open up evidence of access. And the other part about that, which we don't seem to talk about as much, is trying to ensure the effectiveness of that access. It's not enough to give people an opportunity to go talk about their problem. We need to try and put ourselves in a position where we make sure that their problem is truly addressed and dealt with rather than just a topic of conversation someplace. So I was trying to think tonight about, you know, what are the roles that we could play as a board and as an agency? And it seems to me that there's two or three principal ones. One is this opportunity to partner with other people. We have limited resources too. I truly believe Mr. Booth this morning when he said that he did not volunteer the staff to do more work during the discussion at his table, because it's hard for me to conceive of the staff doing more work when we look at what our staff is tasked to do. But we have to find a way to raise our capacity to deal and react to what we've seen today. So the question is, how do we raise our capacity to develop the capacity of other people? And I think that you do that by partnering with anybody you can find. I really like the idea of dating. I like the idea of going to the dance and looking for every partner you can find until you find the one that's a good fit. I'm very pleased to be a part of a board in an agency that seems to truly understand that. So that's not a cultural education that we have to impose on ourselves. We have to, I think, make sure that everybody around us understands that, that we're here to help and we're here to seek help. And we want, I think, also to make sure that whatever response we make and we encourage others to make to this situation is a sustainable process. It's not
throwing money at this problem and this problem and this problem, and then wondering, well, how are we going to address this same suite of needs and other people next year, the year after that? So I really, this idea that you have of your subcommittee, for example, I think that's really, that's awesome. Because it implies that you're going to be there for a while worrying about this problem, and it's not just the first guys through the door that exhaust all the small system salvation that might be available. I think the other thing, another thing we can do is we can act as a kind of a linkage between the local communities and the broader political and agency people, sort of a concierge service. Someone can come to us and say, I need a date, or I need a place to go to talk about this problem. And we can help find that, and we can help give that map. And we can also help interpret the language so that it's not enough to say, go to this office. You have to be able to try to help say, go to this office and talk about these things, because that's what that they're going to be listening for. That's what they're going to mean when they talk to you. Lastly, I think that we can play some kind of advocacy role. At the Water Summit last week, there was a discussion about the idea of how can an agency like this help funnel information into the governor's office, as an example, or into other offices, into the broader EPA office. I think we have a role to do that. I think we are a natural conduit. People come and ask me questions. I haven't the slightest idea what the answer is here in this community, but they at least have a sense that if they ask me, hopefully I'll try to get them pointed in the right direction. Lastly, I think the relationship between this agency and the Regional Integrated Water Planning Bodies is vital. I think it's crucial, because I think this idea of regional planning within watersheds is the future of California, at least in the short term. And I hope that it's being recognized by other people to our advantage. It's a big help to us. The IRWIPs represent a working structure that exists in a watershed that we can make use of, that we don't have to go in and invent some kind of structure in case we ever want to do anything there. And I think the SEP policy that we developed was a recognition of that. Even though I don't think we set out deliberately to do that, we just found kind of by accident that that was a pretty attractive date. I think that we need to convey to people that we have an openness to being a point of access, that we have an openness to trying to move information up the chain, help information come back down the chain. I think we have to advocate and help people find training, technical assistance, administrative assistance, and all the kinds of capacity issues that we've heard about now all day long, so that we can try to assure that each individual project in this region doesn't require the reinvention of the wheel, that we can make it easier for people to go somewhere, talk to somebody who's already done it, maybe get a more simplified process to seek money. So I think there's a lot of things that we can do, but we have to do them with other people. We, for jurisdictional reasons, for legal reasons, for resource reasons, we're not the key to the highway in terms of ensuring that the needs of disadvantaged communities are met. We are the key to the highway for ensuring that our own actions contribute to environmental justice. And that's a mindfulness that we need to build institutionally. Having watched the staff do things, having watched the board do things, I feel like we're on pretty strong footing there. I don't think that we're in a quagmire in that regard. But we're not the key to the highway for getting people's problems solved because they lack resources. I think we're a good partner. I think we're a willing partner. I would encourage people to come and pester us. I do that at my own peril. I understand that. Doesn't make me happy to do it. Every time I do it publicly, I regret it. So I know I'm going to regret having said that.
But I've also learned in 3 years that the people who are somewhat of a pain get some feedback. They get some benefit from that. I'd like to think it's not because we're insensitive to the people who come in front of us and we don't hear them on only one visit, but it's just a fact of life that 3 visits count for more than 1 visit. So I would encourage you to figure out what you need, figure out how we could help, how we could find somebody to help, train a trainer, help a helper, whatever. But this is a dialogue that we need to continue to have constantly. We need to build it into what we do so that we don't do it sporadically, but we have some kind of checking back in. How's it going? What do you need? How can we help? We need to establish contact points. I saw that notion in one of the slides. I think it was Edith. People need to know where they can go to talk to somebody about this thing. I think we probably need to make sure everybody knows those kinds of things. And then we're going to have to commit to each other for many years. But it's a better atmosphere. Patty and I spent a lot of time together in the last week. And one of the things that we've said several times is this is a dire time in California. And it's also a really, really exciting opportunity, because everybody, by the end of this year, and God forbid in the next year, will be forced to re-examine everything they thought they knew about how all of this stuff works. And this is the time to be creative. This is the time to remember those ideas that you thought nobody would ever pay attention to, except maybe the Auburn Dam. And go forward. So I really appreciate what you have done. This was, you know, I love to see people come and say, we're doing this thing, and it's really exciting and it works. I know that there was a tremendous amount of work that the people here locally have put in on this, and it's going to pay off if we just keep hammering at it, and I'm pleased to hopefully be a part of that process.
Sorry.
I apologize.
Nothing to add.
Well, I just wanted to say I'm also passing out to your phone number.
Where is it on that?
That's it.
Mr. Guy.
Question. Mr. Brill, how many members are in your IRWD?
The only reason I hesitate, there's a couple levels. Kind of the heavy lifting, if you will, comes from a relatively large group, about 50 or so, that attend the normal group meetings. They've been meeting for the last 2 years in development of the plan, and we're now going into the implementation phase, and I think this is one piece of that. There is also, the phrase is escaping, but essentially an executive committee that made up by different members that will be actually where their bodies will be approving the plan, and that they hold a little more active. They were a little more active in development of the plan, and again, all these were basically volunteers. Who wants to participate? Who wants to roll their sleeves up and be involved? That's essentially the executive committee. And they also form, as part of the structure, I think that they're about 8, I believe. They also are set up in a formal structure to make decisions, if you will, when necessary, if there is not, quote, broad agreement of a larger group. That hasn't happened yet, but they're set up to be that decision-making body, if you will, where a tiebreaker decision has to be made, where there isn't obviously broad agreement. But for the most part, the group is about 50 strong. And again, it's very diverse across our area. Agricultural, cities, like I said, regulatory entities, DWR is part of that, homeowners association, individuals, you name it, they're profiled on that group.
Regarding funding, are your individual members requested to make annual contributions for the operations?
The operating or the implementing part of it was really almost a case by case, because there will likely be project proponents, and some there may or may not be a project proponent. In this case, kind of there was no project proponent for the small water systems, but in most cases there's a project where there's an obvious lead, the group will defer to them, and the implementing team is designed to help them implement. But usually, there's a single responsible entity. I guess that this one was a little different, and that's where Mojave Water Agency kind of decided to step in and provide catalyst funding, if you will, but really still look to the implement this at implementing team that you saw a few slides ago.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brill. Mr. Carpet, I apologize for putting you on the spot, but since your name has been mentioned several times this meeting, I wonder if you wanted to make some comments.
I warned him that would be like this. Come on.
Thank you for the opportunity. As you can see, Cal Rural Water has worked extensively with both Daniel Mono and the Mojave Water Agency IRWMP team. And I am the Director of Resource Development for Cal Rural Water, so I've been with Cal Rural Water for over 10 years. My focus has always been disadvantaged communities and how can we help them provide the resources that are needed. As you can see, the need exceeds the level of resources that we have, and that all starts with funding. And I think it's just very important that the state board, as well as the regional board, try to work and collaborate with the IRWMP groups in any way they can to see that the disadvantaged communities' needs are met. It's a vast problem. It's a vast challenge. We heard about the issue with rates, as Mark and Holly were mentioning. All of you know that the issue with that is how do they properly set rates? How do they understand what a rate setting tool is, and how do they move to that phase? Well, that's a difficult process when you've got a volunteer board that may not understand that. And so that's just touching on a few of the resources, some of the issues that we face. And I think it's just important that we continue to emphasize the support needed with disadvantaged communities. I will also point out that one of the things that we commonly see, I know it was brought up by Amy in regards to the fact of how do these small communities, what do they do with their compliance? How do they handle the groundwater contamination? What's done? And, I'll just point out there, I think, the importance is how do we get them to the next phase of understanding how do you fund that project? And, the key has been, or the issues that I've seen in the past, is a small water system can apply for funding, they can put out public notification, and they can just operate with their arsenic problem. And I think we have to go back and look, how do we help them really solve this and create a solution that they'll really be able to operate that system, have the right treatment operator. There's a lot of logistics, but how do we get there? And again, it goes back to the capacity of operations. So I think that's the focus of the IRWMP groups. We're proud to be partners with Mojave Water Agency, Daniel Mono, IRWMP. We also work with the San Diego group. We work with the North Coast IRWMP. And all of these have been excellent partnerships in trying to help.
I've been really pleased with this whole item. I think it brings to bear a really important issue for our region. To follow up what Pete had said, it is a very exciting time. And I do see the shift turning so much on environmental justice and helping disadvantaged communities. I started my career working on the original definition thing. I worked with Hilda Sleeps back then to do that. It's changed so much over the years. This is really the time when it's changing. There'll be new programs, new policies the State Board has enacted, both in water rights and others, groundwater management. There's money being put into databases. We'll have more information to make decisions on. And I'm starting to believe with the water body passing some of the initiative money to the budget, there'll be monies to help disadvantaged communities on some of the issues we've talked about today. We as the regional board need to further this. I'm very lucky that I've been blessed with talented and very caring staff who deal with these EJ issues on a day-to-day basis, from permits they issue to enforcement actions they take to assisting them on the roads, you know, that we're embedding this into our day-to-day operation. I'm looking for Teresa, she went over backwards with the small water business we were working with to help them with the RC problem because we're at the price. She went over backwards and spent extra trips to these folks to help them. And that's the kind of stuff we need. That's the kind of and with all these ideas, including ones that Pete had mentioned, ones we're thinking already, the dating structure of everything else in training and technical assistance, and it is my hope to put together a document with our staff of various ideas and recommendations and pass it on to the State Board. In terms of advocacy, I think what you know that whoever will listen, I talk to them in Sacramento or other places, whether they like it or not, of some ideas of things to do. So I think putting this document that we're going to prepare and write is going to be part of that. Because I've already, some of the board members of the State Board already have said that we're really looking forward to seeing that. So it's been a great discussion and a lot of movement, a lot of great people working on these issues. I guess I great faith that we're going to see some wonderful improvement in terms of water quality and public health protection, particularly in disadvantaged communities. Also, individuals, because I feel like disadvantaged communities is a binding definition. And the one thing I wanted to say on the last note of the sidebar on the virus screen program, which is a phenomenal database, and it really is an excellent tool. And for the southern part of our region, it does clearly identify those parts of our region that have cumulative impact that's being disadvantaged. But at the same time, parts of our region that don't have bad air quality, that have bad water quality, they may get costed out of funding. So that's another thing I'd like to bring to the decision makers, because of the direction of funding and priority seems to be going into the environmental impact approach. And that really disadvantages already disadvantaged communities of water quality.
I know that oftentimes most of the work in the meetings is done in side conversations as opposed to forums like this. And so, Sue, if I may ask you, do we turn into a pumpkin at a certain time here, or can people mingle and have side conversations after we adjourn?
They may.
Okay.
They may. You know, I do want to go to bed before midnight, so just keep that in mind.
Okay, very good. Mine is 9 o'clock now. So we'll adjourn until tomorrow morning.